Welcome back to Beyond Texas. It's been a while since I last shared Alona's story about her harrowing escape from Mariupol, Ukraine. An update on her. She's moved further west to Dnipro, away from the hottest war zone of eastern Ukraine. She's managed to rent an apartment there and acquire some clothes and to begin life again. People from this podcast and others have responded to our GoFundMe for Alona, and we've been able to raise about $2,000 for her, which has helped her cover rent and food for about, well, the next 3 months or so. As she told me, she has been moved to tears over the idea that strangers from so far away would be willing to help her. She struggled to find work because, after all, there's a war going on. But she says at least this support frees her to help feed shut-ins and assist in getting war supplies to the soldiers. She's out volunteering her assistance every day. If you'd like to pitch in to help her still, you can donate by Googling "A Little Help for My Ukrainian Friend." You just Google that, "A Little Help for My Ukrainian Friend," and it'll get you to the GoFundMe campaign we've set up for her. Thanks again for your wonderful generosity on her behalf. Our show today is about the history of transplants, one of the most life-saving trends in the history of medicine. I have Paul Craddock here. He has his PhD in the history of medicine and has just published a mesmerizing book called Spare Parts, The Story of Medicine Through the History of Transplant Surgery. It's a number one new release on Amazon, a top seller in medical history, and it's getting rave reviews from both sides of the Atlantic. For instance, stuffed with eccentric characters and questionable experiments, this is a joyful romp through a fascinating slice of medical history. Wendy Moore, author of The Knife Man. Also, a riveting journey through the story of anatomical alchemy, filled with adventure, delight, and surprise, by Dr. Jandil, surgeon and author of Life on a Knife's Edge. And there's this one from an Amazon reader. Craddock's book is a winner. It is a mesmerizing work because of the extraordinary stories that are so beautifully crafted. They serve to illustrate the trends in the history and animate those trends flawlessly. Additionally, I love the numerous paintings and illustrations that Craddock included in the book that complemented many aspects of this tumultuous, beautiful, though sometimes macabre history. Never a dull moment here. 5 stars. Signed, W.F. Strong. Yes, and that's my objective review. I loved it, and I think you will as well. Paul and I have so much to cover, I'm going to do this in 2 parts. About 30 minutes this week, and another 30 minutes with Paul next week. Here we go. So let's begin with your New York Times review. It was magnificent.
Oh, thank you very much. It was much more than I expected. It was longer than I expected.
Oh, it was very long. And in fact, as I was reading it, I thought, you know, this is like one of those really long movie trailers where they almost cover too much, you know. They tell you too much. Say, okay, I've read the book now. One of the things I found difficult in your book to read about was the history of noses. So I guess in the ancient world, people just had their noses cut off a lot.
Yes. In fact, there was a city of people whose noses were cut off. It was a fairly common punishment. Mm-hmm. But in much of the world, for much of history, you could also lose your nose in a war, mm-hmm. fighting with sabers,
yeah,
or in a duel, mm-hmm. again sabers or some other, I suppose gunfire would be less likely to just hit your nose, but I suppose it's a possibility. But also in 16th century Italy, syphilis was rife, so you also had that, you know, disease eating away at the nose.
So I didn't realize that syphilis took the nose.
It doesn't to these days, but mm-hmm. it was a far more serious strain of the disease back then. And it leaves you, well, it left you, it doesn't leave you anymore. It left you with what they used to call a saddle nose. And it looks extremely painful.
I'm sure. And then so this colony of people who were noseless, live together because they shared the same deformity and they wouldn't be ostracized?
Well, I presume so. When I found out about this, it just sort of, you know, it was in an encyclopedia, an old encyclopedia,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't find any other entries about this giving me a definite reason. But I presume it's because it's if you lose your nose, you're ostracized in
sure.
a way.
And yeah.
if you couldn't in the ancient world or the Renaissance world, you couldn't lead.
Mm-hmm.
Lead a country if you had no nose. Justinian II overturned that by having a false nose made of mm-hmm. gold.
Mm-hmm. And you wrote about that, about how someone couldn't be king in that kingdom unless they were so to speak, perfect. So if they didn't have a nose,
yeah.
they were imperfect and couldn't be king. They were afraid of competition, so they had the noses cut off of the sons who might be competition.
Oh, yes, that was Justinian's family, and he wanted one particular son to have the kingdom, so he cut off the noses of his other sons, and then he cut off the nose of his lieutenant, and then he cut off the nose of someone else. You know, all these people cutting off people's noses to sort of block their way into kingdom, kinghood, to stop them becoming kings.
So this is connected to organ transplant in the sense that they couldn't transplant a nose, but they could graft skin, right?
Yes, it's connected because one way that Justinian got around this was to have a nose made of gold, and he stormed the city and retook.
And proved the theory wrong.
Proved the theory wrong, once and for all. But a nose mask guy, if you look at some pictures of nose masks, they look like those party masks that children get in party bags. A nose attached to some glasses, mm-hmm. for example, with a little mustache, I don't know. but there was an alternative. And an alternative that had been around technically since ancient times. So in ancient India, there was a procedure that was considered traditional even in ancient India, to take skin from the forehead and to transplant that onto the nose. So you'd basically make incisions around the forehead, pull some skin off and form it into the shape of a nose, and then make fresh incisions around where the nose would be, and then that skin would heal to the skin around the nose,
mm-hmm.
and it would form a new nose, and it'd be quite convincing by all accounts. But we lose records of that, and they start to emerge again in Italy in the 16th century in 1549. And by that time, a skin graft was a procedure performed solely and exclusively by peasants, secretive families of surgeons who would have their own sort of technique to take skin from the head or forearm at that point as well, and to transplant that to the nose or the lip or the ear.
So this was a bottom up science, so to speak. It came out of the people, grassroots, rather than what often happens.
Yes, I'm sometimes asked about it being the cutting edge of science in the 16th century, but it was never, well, it sort of is the cutting edge in a way, I suppose, but it was never really the cutting edge because it's a procedure that stretches back literally millennia, and it actually comes from horticulture.
Uh-huh.
It's a direct transposition, in fact, from, the kinds of operations that were performed on trees, on apples and pears. Grafting those.
How so?
Well, there's no real records on how that transposition was made, but the procedures are extremely similar. Mm-hmm. Basically, you're making two incisions and you're connecting two organisms or parts of an organism, and you're binding them together
mm-hmm.
so that those two parts meld and they become one.
Okay.
And the technique is actually reflected in the technique of horticulture is reflected in the technique as the surgeons performed on skin. So you bind those wounds.
It was an analogy they carried over to another realm, you might say.
It was, and when the person called Leonardo Fioravanti, he took a chance, mm-hmm. and he visited one of these secretive surgeons, the Anio family, and he rocked up at their door in 1549, and he said he's got a relative who'd been fighting in Lombardy, a lot of wars, so you know it was quite possible that was the case. And he said, well, he's heard about this skin graft, and he's wondering whether it might be a solution for his relatives. So, would you mind if I watched you operate? And of course, it was a secret technique, so they weren't that happy about it. But he somehow convinced them. But he was completely lying. He was a surgeon. He was a surgeon who would try to find out the secrets that nature taught people, and this was one of those. So he watched his operation with his hands over his eyes, but he was looking through his glasses very carefully at what they were doing. He was writing down exactly what he saw. And so, how he described it was the agriculture of the body. And the farming of them. So even then they had that connection.
How interesting. And so this was really folk medicine. The way today sometimes, you know, the scientists learn from the folk medicine and then they take the herb and they make a medicine of it and make it more effective.
Sort of. I mean, mm-hmm. today it's scientists, today the legitimate medical professionals, I should say, because there was no real scientists, so to speak, in that era. But mm-hmm. legitimate medical professionals will knowingly knowingly accept, you know, the basis of some folk remedy. Mm-hmm. But back in the 16th century, Leonardo Fioravanti was a complete outlier. Mm-hmm. Medical professionals trusted the written word and the written word of Galen, you know, the physician of the gladiators in the mm-hmm. 2nd century AD. Mm-hmm. It's I think that's the date. Most legitimate medical professionals would trust those written sources.
I see.
But Fioravanti actually went out into the countryside and he learned as much as he could from the people.
Galen was a god, right, in the medical world at that time.
Oh, yes. Well, he was taken extremely seriously, and he was the most important physician until at least the 18th century.
Really? I mean, for 1600 years?
Yes. his work was the basis of a whole system of medicine, and a system of medicine that didn't really include transplant surgery of any kind. So up until the 16th century, transplant surgery had no relationship with legitimate medicine, and legitimate medicine was Galen's style of medicine. Mm-hmm.
Were the first transplants beyond the grafting, was it transplantation of teeth? Would that be the first time we have real transplants from one person to another?
It depends what you mean. Well, it depends what you mean by a real transplant. Mm-hmm. We also have blood transfusions.
That's true.
Emerged
yes.
in the early 17th century. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we think of blood transfusions as a replacement of blood, of matter that has mm-hmm. been lost through some kind of trauma. Back then, that was not the case. It was considered a transplantation of something like a soul or a part of someone's personality. So it's a completely different way of looking at transplant. And actually, that's what's interesting about that is you have two medical systems working in tandem. Mm-hmm. So with blood transfusion, first you need to recognize that the blood circulates the body, and therefore that you can conceive of the body as at least partly mechanical. Mm-hmm. And that means that you can connect two systems.
How successful were those early? I mean, they didn't know blood types, so they were bound to be putting the wrong blood type into people and killing them.
Oh, it was much worse than that.
Oh, no.
It was much worse than that.
Oh, no.
Because the donors were not human.
Oh.
The donors were animals.
Mm.
And that's because of the other medical system, which is the Galenic and Aristotelian medical system. Blood, no one really knew what was, we knew blood circulated. By the 17th century, we knew it, you know, as a circulatory system, but we didn't know what the blood itself was, what was in it.
Mm-hmm.
So people, medical professionals, doctors, physicians, proto-scientists, they looked still back to Galen, back to those ancient systems, back to religion as well, and folk tales to sort of think what the blood, what could possibly be in the blood. Some guesses were things like, you know, if life itself, a vital spirit. So if you transfuse the blood of a young cow, that would make you younger.
Oh, the fountain of youth.
The fountain of youth, absolutely. And it comes from Ovid. Some of the first blood transfusionists actually directly referred to the Roman poet Ovid. He told the stories of, you know, things like Jason and the Argonauts, the story of Medea, who rejuvenates Jason's father with a magical potion, which is fed into his bloodstream, which rejuvenates a part of his blood. So it was, they were kind of referencing these ancient stories to sort of try to understand what might happen.
I'm curious about the technology. How did they get the blood from an animal into a person?
Well, there are a few possibilities. One of the most exciting ones would be using a porcupine quill. You'd hollow that out. You'd use that as a conduit, a makeshift blood vessel.
Huh. Interesting.
You could also use hollowed out reeds.
Mm-hmm.
Some people made glass tubes or brass, used brass as well. So anything that actually, that's another part of the, you know, the mechanization of the body. People started to conceive of body parts as mechanical contraptions. So you can introduce an artificial blood vessel to connect to systems. So it becomes very much, the body starts to resemble an industrial machine in a way.
At the time, they didn't think of the heart as a pump?
By that point, they did. That was part of understanding the circulatory system. To understand the heart as a muscle.
You point out early in your book that way back in ancient Chinese lore was the idea that the heart was the center of the personality in the brain, right?
In that thought system, it was, yes. So you have stories of Chinese stories of heart transplants where the heart transplant recipient would become more intelligent.
So the brain was in the heart.
So to speak.
Very interesting. Very interesting. It would be so hard to make that paradigm shift to think of that being the seat of knowledge. You know, you always think, as we've been raised in this scientific culture for all these years, and we automatically think that, you know, our brain is right behind our eyes, that we feel like it's right there. And, you know, to be able to make that switch.
Yes. It's very interesting how where people consider themselves to be, isn't it? As you pointed out, we sort of consider ourselves to be in our brain. It used to, you know, for many people, it used to be the heart. And I was reading in J.G. Fraser's The Golden Bough about, I think it was a Polynesian tribe who considered themselves to be in their testicles. And that's, yes. I don't know about the women. Perhaps they didn't have cells. but they thought that because they would lower themselves onto the themselves. That's them. They would lower themselves onto the base, the bottom of their canoes, mm-hmm. and through their testicles, they would feel the current, and they would know, you know, the waterways in that way. So they felt they were in their testicles.
There's a lot of modern women who would agree with them that that's where men's brains are.
Oh, yeah. No comment.
When was the first transplant that we think of as a transplant today? I mean, I had never thought of skin as being a transplant, but obviously you make a very good and valid case for that. Let's talk about teeth before we get to what we might call the first, because, I mean, that blew my mind, is the idea that people would get someone else's teeth and put it in their mouth, and there were successes and failures in this.
Yes, it's not a natural. It's not a natural urge, is it? It doesn't feel like it. Something very important happened in the 18th century, and that is the birth of the modern world. Really, at least, you know, in what has come to be called the West, you had, you know, things like shopping emerging, fashion, the beauty industry. You had coffee shops. Popping up. So the modern world really started to emerge along with its widening inequalities, its class system. And along with that came a new kind, a new conception of identity. So we've just been talking about blood transfusion, where you have this idea where a personality or a bit of someone's or something's soul or quality gets transplanted. And that's because that worked with the idea that the soul was indivisible. You were an indivisible thing, soul inside of your body. So you inhabited your body. Mm. But by the 18th century, that for many people no longer makes sense. You become a composition of things. So you identify with what you buy, what you own. So another thing that was that changed in the 18th century is that you had a completely different kind of identity emerging. Mm-hmm. So we've just been talking about blood transfusions, and they worked really because blood transfusions were supposed to transplant a soul or a bit of someone's personality or something's essence. That's how it works when you transplant a sheep's calmness to an insane person. It calms that insane person down. Well, he doesn't really, but it's yeah. You know, that's
that was
that's
the theory.
What they thought. That was the theory. But by the 18th century, that theory no longer makes sense to most people, because you have all these new trappings of modern life emerging, and people start to identify with things, with the things they bought, the things that they own, things that are done to them. Whatever, you know, you identify with, you are no longer that essence. You're no longer an essence that is indivisible. You are now a composition. You're an individual in a quite modern sense of that term. So, I mean, some historians call that process individuation, because in the 18th century, that's when this modern idea of an individual comes about. So you've got all that happening socially, all this widening class system, these inequalities, you have fashion and beauty, concern over appearance, and you have this new kind of identity. And from all of that emerges a new science, and that's the science of dentistry.
Hmm.
So the term dentist comes from 1728, and it's French, dentiste. And when that profession was emerging, you had, you know, familiar, horrible, horrendous dental operations being invented as well. So Pierre Fouchard, who invented the term dentiste, he had a menu of services which included things like filling your teeth, and filing them, also washing your mouth out with urine, which we don't tend to do anymore. But transplanting teeth was one of those things on the menu. And he has a few stories of army officers who would lose their teeth and get the privates to accompany him and have their teeth transplanted.
Oh my!
Very cruel. And it's you know, on and off, it's been going on again probably for centuries. There are Renaissance stories of tooth transplants, one or two, even skulls that have been dug up from long, long ago that looked like they've had transplanted teeth. But it was in the last part of the 18th century when, you know, the Industrial Revolution really got underway and the middle classes started to swell and the poverty-stricken classes became even more poverty-stricken and desperate. That's when you get sort of a perfect storm. So you had dentists brokering deals between the wealthy, the rotten-toothed wealthy who, you know, ruined their teeth through their sugar consumption, and the poor children whose newly erupted adult teeth were pristine and could be yanked out and put into the gap of an older lady or gentleman of quality, they used to call them.
I'm just curious, though, but did the transplanted tooth take root, or did it just kind of have the gums seal around it and it was loose in there?
Well, sometimes it apparently took root. I mean, it would be very hit and miss, and I can't imagine very many of them taking root. The army officer I mentioned a moment ago, he apparently reported that before it started to decay, his transplanted tooth was in place and he fined for 6 years. John Hunter, who was a scientist who gave a lot of credibility to the tooth transplant, actually, he reported even using dead teeth that he'd found, that he'd had sent to him from battlefield. There was the term Waterloo teeth. So from a peninsula war, from Waterloo, barrels of teeth from corpses shipped.
They call them Waterloo teeth?
Waterloo teeth, they call them, yeah.
Wow.
And they'd be shipped to dentists who would use them mainly in dentures, which is still a bit weird, isn't it? But also transplanted, and apparently sometimes they would work just as well. And he put that down to, you know, you can have a whole barrel and you can find the size that fits the hole.
Oh, my.
Much more leisure.
It's macabre and funny because of it, I suppose. But now you said that there was a downside to this. Sometimes people got more than the tooth when they transplanted it.
You could say that. Sometimes they got, I hazard to guess most times, they probably got some kind of infection. So syphilis could be transmitted this way. Some high-profile people died, actually. And when those kinds of, you know, really important figures started to die, that's when they started to abandon tooth transplants. The last one I'd heard of was in 1835, and that was in Buffalo, New York. And I've actually seen it. It was never really banned, I don't think. And I've actually seen it as a legitimate technique in a textbook printed as late as 1919.
That's 100 years ago.
I've never heard of any cases. It's not that long ago. I've not seen any cases performed that late, nowhere near. It fizzled out by the beginning of the 19th century, more or less, really.
Well, let's jump up to modern times. The only country, I think, that allows people to sell their organs today for transplant is Iran. Is that right?
Yes, that's as far as I know. It should just be Iran at the moment. Yeah.
And how does it work there? If I'm in Iran and I want to sell my kidney, how do I do that?
Do you know, I've never tried.
You haven't tried to sell one yet?
I've never tried. I don't know how it works. I don't know how they manage that. No, well, most of the world has something like the Human Tissue Authority, to really manage any organ donations. In Iran, I think it's quite a different matter.
Well, you make a point in the book where you say that they're the only country that doesn't have a backlog of need, that because they have capitalized the system, the supply and demand is equal.
Yes, and I don't know how. Well, I do know how I feel about that. Actually, I think it's quite difficult to justify. In history, we've just been talking about tooth transplants. There was a free market in tooth transplants as well, but every case, pretty much, you can put down to the poor being cajoled into giving up their anatomical assets for money out of desperation.
Sure. We have that today. The black market works that way, right? The poor are cajoled into giving up their organs for $5,000 or $6,000 for a kidney.
Absolutely, and it's a horrendous practice. I mean, you can understand why recipients or potential recipients will go to those lengths, knowing that the wait for an organ is so long.
Mm-hmm.
It can be years.
Yeah,
and you can understand why the donors do it as well. If they're just completely desperate.
Yes.
It's really the brokers that capitalize on those different kinds of pain and suffering, just like the dentists in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm. You have watched a transplant, right? You've seen one?
I did. Yes. Yes, and I must say, I am not a medic. And I found it extremely boring. Because 4 hours, and you don't really know what's going on a technical level. Well, I didn't. If you knew your stuff, you would, and you might be excited by it. But to me, it's a lot of standing around waiting towards the end. There's a sort of moment of crescendo, and that's when the organ is actually taken, so to speak, by the body. It pinks up, they say. So I started when I saw an organ come to life inside of a body for the first time, it changed the way I looked at that procedure. It was no longer boring. In fact, I saw a musical structure as having an opening sonata. It's an 18th century symphony I'm going to tell you about now. It had an opening sonata. You literally cut your way into the meat of the subject. So that's the sonata done. Then you are exploring the internal landscape. You're marking things out with bits of thread. You're preparing the site. You're preparing the kidney. And you're lifting the kidney all very slowly. And you're lifting the kidney, putting it into place and sewing it in, fastening the vessels of the body to the vessels of the kidney. And then they put clamps on, and then the pace changes again when they open the clamp and blood rushes in. And it goes literally before your eyes. It turns from gray to pink in seconds. And it's like the body starts to, to continue the musical sort of metaphor, it starts to dance. There's a minuet. And things start to, the pace picks up. And then you have a closing sonata, which is, of course, the reverse of the opening one, and then you've got your entire 18th century symphony there represented in a kidney transplant. So that's what I got from watching the transplant, actually. I drew together some themes, of course, for the book, but really it was this conception of a transplant as a piece of choreography, but also a piece of music with a structure, with rhythms, and with timbre.
That's a beautiful analogy, Paul. That's all the time we have this week. Next week, I'll talk with Paul some more, and we'll cover the big daddy of transplants, the heart. If you'd like to pick up his book now, you can get it on Amazon, of course, as Spare Parts by Paul Craddock. And if you enjoy his exceptional British diction and rhythm, you can get it as an audiobook narrated by, of course, Paul. I'm W.F. Strong. You've been listening to Beyond Texas. Get out there and tell some good stories of your own. There's nothing more influential in this world than good stories well told.